Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Buffalo, New York, and earned a BA in Business and Organizational Communications from the University of Akron. In 1977, he joined the Pro Football Hall of Fame as its curator/researcher, and since 2015, he's been the co-host of the popular weekly national radio show Pro Football Hall of Fame Radio on Sirius XM. The author of numerous books, he's regarded as the world's most renowned historian on professional football. His name? Joe Horrigan. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the world's most renowned historian on professional football. At least that's what he says about himself, Joe Horrigan. Welcome, a real honor to have you.
It's an honor to be on, Jack. Long overdue.
Yes.
We've been friends for a long time. I'm proud to tell your listeners.
Let's start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please.
Yeah, you know, I've been in this business, I was telling somebody just the other night, for all of my life, literally. My first job was 13 years old. And I would go into my father's office in the American Football League office in New York and work weekends, keeping the league scrapbooks and going through and measuring column inches of coverage for the American Football League, which is who he worked for, versus the evil NFL, our competitor, and just to make sure that we're getting our even shake in the New York market in particular, but all the other NFL cities or AFL cities. And then at the tender age of 14, I was the runner at the 1964 AFL draft, which would take my brother and I, he was 15, and we would run from the KLM building on New York's Fifth Avenue over to Park Avenue on to the Waldorf Astoria, delivering the draft picks for the American Football League draft. And I am where I'm at right now. I'm sitting in a room by myself, and there was probably I'd say the crowd of media that I took the draft results to that year was maybe fivefold of what I am looking at right now, and I'm only looking at myself. So it was not many. It was a very small reception. It wasn't like the draft of today where, you know, waited with bated breath. In fact, there were 23 rounds that year. So by the time we were done, I think they had called everybody who'd played college football that year. I think his name was called for some team or another. So it was a long, arduous process. But I've been in the business since. Nearly, it's been a labor of love. My father, as you mentioned, was Jack Horrigan. He was with the American Football League. He began as a sports writer with the Buffalo Evening News and the United Press before that. And then we came back to Buffalo when I was 16, and my father became vice president, public relations director for the Buffalo Bills with Ralph Wilson, a dear friend. And other than when I was in college and I spent 4 years in the service, every year other than those, I've been working in pro football. I've been at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. As you said, I started out as a curator, and I'm executive director now, and I've been there for 41 years. I'll be starting my 42nd year here in a couple months.
You have a great place in your heart for the AFL and the Buffalo Bills, and the late, great Ralph Wilson was from Grosse Pointe, lived here till the end of his time, recently set aside $2 billion, the foundation, to give to Buffalo and Detroit. Tell us one or two stories about Ralph Wilson.
Well, Ralph was a lifelong friend in my case because I did know him my entire life, literally. And he was a special man. He did so many things that he never told people about. I just mentioned his name not 10 minutes ago, visiting the Holocaust Museum in Skokie. And they were talking about Hiroshima. And I said, well, I can tell you something. I said, the first American to visit Hiroshima after the bomb was dropped was Ralph Wilson. And that's a true story. He was a commander on a minesweeper. He was in the Pacific, and his relevant location to Hiroshima at the time after the bomb, they sent him in, literally on his little 110-foot wooden boat, minesweeper to observe the damage. And he would tell the story that, you know, they were met there on the shores, and he says, we didn't know if we were going to be saluted or shot. So it was, you know, it was kind of frightening. But, you know, he firsthand witnessed the devastation of war. But then he was also there and was invited to join the, all the other officers that were there for the signing of the end of the war with Japan. So he was on the ship, the Missouri, during the signing. So, he's, you know, he really had a very significant role in World War II, served in both the Atlantic and Pacific theaters. But, and I think it shaped a lot of the character of the man, because he was someone who really wanted to help others. And I can tell you firsthand, his friendship with my father, he was very, very good to my father, who died a very young man, 47. But he had been battling cancer since he was 36. But that didn't stop Ralph from, you know, hiring him and saying, you know, I will not only want you to, you know, work for me, but if you agree to, he says, I will see that your children have the opportunity to go to college. And my father was, had 10 children. So that was no simple pledge. But obviously he was a very generous man, and he took care of my mom when my dad died, and he's been very good to my family. So I have nothing but love in my heart for Ralph.
The AFL days in the early 60s, the Wild West. Can you share with us one or two great stories about the AFL days?
Yeah, you know, the AFL was it was a special time in pro football history, because, you know, you didn't play on a team. You played for a league. And that's how the players felt. A lot of them were cast-offs from the NFL, getting second chances, and some were forgetting chances that might not have come without the AFL, specifically from historically black colleges. Opportunity and competition breeds opportunity. The AFL needed players, and in the NFL, the racial barriers hadn't completely disappeared from sport yet. So a lot of that was coming from historically black colleges, which were being scouted by the AFL because they needed good players. And they certainly found great players. But some of the great stories, you know, really was how the teams, you know, worked to, you know, combat what they considered their enemy in the National Football League. They would literally, when they're going to draft, you know, there's two different drafts. There's the AFL draft and the NFL draft. And they would literally kidnap players and get them in a hotel room until, you know, until they got signed. You know, guys are jumping out of hotel, you know, windows, not tied up on the first floor of motel windows, and, you know, to escape their babysitters, they were called. They were under a lot of pressure to sign contracts. And there was a case where Billy Cannon, who was drafted by the NFL and the AFL, Bud Adams with the Houston Oilers signed him for the AFL, but he had signed him after he'd already signed a contract with the NFL. But Bud took him to his home, and driving up his long driveway to his beautiful home, Bud was a very wealthy man. He saw Bud's wife had a Cadillac parked in the driveway and drove past that and didn't mention it. So in any case, Bud is negotiating with Billy and thinks he's got a deal. And he said to Billy, he says, is there anything else I can get you to sign with our team? And he says, well, you know, driving up the driveway with you, I saw that Cadillac out there. He says, my dad always wanted a Cadillac. He never could afford one. It'd really be nice if I could get him a Cadillac. So, you know, Bud files that away, and after they, you know, negotiate their deal, Billy leaves, and Bud's wife comes in a little bit later, and she says, Bud, where'd my car go? Bud gave Billy Cannon her car.
It worked. It worked.
So, you know, it was an easy way to get him his last request. Give him a Cadillac. There's one right in the driveway waiting for you. So those are the kind of shenanigans that went on in the day. But it was a different day, a different age. You know, the NFL and pro football and the AFL were just beginning to, supplant baseball as America's pastime. So it was an exciting time if you're a football fan, and television was blossoming and helped to move the game to that next level.
We're talking to Joe Horrigan, Football Hall of Fame, and I'm Jack Crystal, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and with Joe Horrigan, who since 1977 has been with the Football Hall of Fame in many different roles. Joe, how do you explain America's love affair with football?
You know, it is what I call really a social phenomenon, because, you know, it is like no other sport in the sense of it is a team sport, and there's a team commitment, and there's a different way of looking at it, and that team commitment expands beyond the locker room into communities, and communities take great pride in a bunch of men playing a sport under their city's name. Now, it happens in other sports as well, obviously, but because pro football has a limited number of games, they become more, every game is important, and because it is such a, and I'll use the word violent game, it's a physical game, that people have this emotion that's going through the whole game all the time. It's not, you know, you can't take a nap during a football game, or you miss it. So it's one of those things where it's a connection between forces, you know, physical forces, community, and the feeling of victory that we all look for in every walk of life, in every way, that just unites us under one common theme. And it doesn't matter what color you are, it doesn't matter what your race is, it doesn't matter what your religion is. If you can move the ball forward, that's all that matters. And it becomes kind of symbolic for life. You know, that's, you know, how we should probably look at life a little bit more, is that we're a team trying to move the ball forward. And I think that's what, you know, really makes the love affair for football, because there is that connection between making the team do the work.
You've been with the Pro Football Hall of Fame since 77. It's in Canton, Ohio. Its mission is to honor the heroes of the game, preserve its history, promote its values, and celebrate excellence everywhere. And you've been the curator for many years. What does a curator do?
Well, when I started there, we were a much smaller organization, and then one of my first obligations really was to physically expand the collection, which was, you know, again, in 77, the building had only opened in 63, and when it opened, it was a very small operation. So we went on the world's largest football scavenger hunt, looking for those meaningful artifacts, three-dimensional pieces that could help preserve and tell the story of the game. So I spent a lot of time doing that, but then also on the two-dimensional world of archives and paper and knowledge, that was really what we spent a lot of time recreating and validating and explaining the history of the game all the way back to 1892 when pro football began. There was no place that had ever done that. The league had not maintained very good historical records or evidence, or at least in an organized fashion. So we started going out and trying to put that together, and we now have what is the Ralph Wilson Research and Preservation Center at the Hall of Fame, which has more than 40 million pages of documents, 6 million images. We're in hard copy, we're in digital copy, we're in microfiche and microfilm. It is the world's largest collection now of pro football history. And we're proud to say last November we became the first major sports museum ever to be awarded national accreditation from the American Alliance of Museums. So we've come a long way since 63 and a long way since I got there in 77, and we're going a long way towards our future.
Speaking of future, the NFL has been going on for 98 years. There have been 27,000-plus men have played the game. Mm-hmm. Only with the eight most recent inductees, the Hall will have 318 members. Let's right. talk about a few, okay?
Sure.
Joe Carr.
One of my favorites. It's a name that most sports fans aren't even familiar with. He was the second president of the American Professional Football Association, which became the National Football League a year later. But Jim Thorpe, for the first year, was the president, and he was really just it was a honorary position for him. He was not there because he was a great administrator. He was there because of his name. Where in 1921, the teams that existed in the NFL realized if they were going to survive, which they were having a hard time doing, they needed an administrator. And Joe Carr had not only been an administrator at football, but he was an executive in minor league baseball as well. So he had a great background. He worked for the Ohio State Journal, which was a newspaper, as a sports writer, and just had great vision. He was a real visionary. And he single-handedly, and I think he is maybe the most overlooked man in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He's so important to the evolution of the sport. He began right away to try and model what was then the loose-knit group of owners into kind of what was Major League Baseball. He saw that pro football was in small, mostly Midwestern, some Northeastern cities, where there wasn't college football for the most part, and there were minor league baseball teams. But he knew that from the minor league baseball experience that in order to survive, they either had to have a physical presence in major league cities or have the illusion of being a part of major league cities. So in a long roundabout way, what he did do is he expanded any and everywhere he could, but he was trying to find those minor league baseball cities that had stadiums, which was very important because they were, till that point, were playing in basically fields with bleachers around them. So he knew if we were going to survive, the only way to make money for a sport team back then was attendance. You know, you didn't have television, you didn't have radio, you didn't have any real marketing of any kind. So attendance was what would, you know, pay the freight. So he tried to get them into population bases where there was at least minor league baseball teams. But his bigger dream was to, you know, have a lot of teams to get started to help pay the bills for the league and continue to grow. But he really wanted a smaller major city league, which is what he eventually got with his reorganization starting in 1927, 28, and 29. He went from small-town teams into major league cities. I mean, the Canton Bulldogs and Akron Pros and the Toledo Maroons and teams like those fell off in favor of the Chicago Bears, the Chicago Cardinals, the New York Giants. And he put several different attempts in cities like Buffalo and Cleveland, and Detroit had several teams before they finally settled on the Lions. So it was his vision that did that. I actually have a newspaper story, Jack, that in 1933, he's visiting in Minneapolis, Minnesota for a minor league baseball executives meeting, and he learned of the city fathers were going to build an arena in Minneapolis, and he's quoted as saying, if they had the proper vision, they would understand that our game is moving towards indoors. And if they were smart, they would build that arena to be large enough to facilitate pro football. So in 1933, he's talking about dump stadiums. I mean, it was like, this is the kind of vision the guy had. Now, two dome stadiums later, Minnesota just had a Super Bowl. So it's it was that kind of vision that made Joe Carr so special. And without his vision, the league would never have made it through the 20s.
Our own Detroit native MSU grad, Joe DeLamelier, please.
My buddy. Joe D is one of the kindest, gentle giants I know. I can't say enough about him. I've known him since he was a player, and even when he was a player, it was obvious that he had this special heart. And he grew up in Detroit, and his dad ran a gin mill there, and one of, I believe, eight or nine children, youngest or second youngest, somewhere in there. But he grew up with that blue-collar mentality and that kind heart that I think comes from having his mother in his life, and he went to Catholic school and a big family. All of that taught him a lot of life lessons. But he has taken from what he was able to capture as a player, and now wearing a gold jacket of the Hall of Fame, as he tells people, he says, I know people wouldn't know Joe DeLamelier if I weren't wearing a Hall of Fame gold jacket. But he says, but I'm using that gold jacket to help others. This guy wrote, he and his two college roommates at Michigan State, one of whom was adopted and wanted to give something back because of the good life he had from adoptive parents. And Joe, actually had adopted children and had foster children and biological children. So they had this common link, to make a long story short. But the three roommates, decided they were going to raise money to help build an orphanage in Matamoros, Mexico. And they decided they would do it by riding bicycles from Michigan State, where they met and grew up together, down to Mexico. And this was like a 3,000-mile bike trip that they took. And they raised money, and they did build an orphanage down there and was working on a second one. But Joe, Joe, who just is so understated, he tells me one day long afterwards, he says, I probably shouldn't tell you this because I know once I tell you, everybody's going to know, which I'm telling you now on the radio. But Joe confessed to me, he said, I had never ridden a 10-speed bike in my life, and I didn't know how to shift gears. He said, I just left it in third gear for 3,000 miles. I said, Joe, only you could do that. But there's so many stories I could tell you of his generosity. He met a young man who was literally selling baked goods outside a store to raise money to help fund. He needed replacement prosthetic legs. If you reach a certain age, it's no longer covered by your insurance, and he outgrew them. So Joe just took that to heart and said, you know, I've got two good legs, and I'm going to, you know, work with these two good legs of mine. And maybe the hottest week in the history of Ohio, he started a walk from Ralph Wilson Stadium in Buffalo, where he played. He said, I'm going to walk to the Hall of Fame, which is 230 miles later. And he walked, you know, he and Bernie Kosar actually joined him for about the last 100 miles. And they walked to Canton, Ohio to raise money for this young man who he didn't even know. I mean, he just did it because he saw a need. But that's the kind of thing that he does. And you know, for those of your listeners who don't know him from his pro football career, Joe was a great part of the electric company and with the Buffalo Bills that blocked for O.J. Simpson for his 2,000-yard season, the first player to do that, and was a great teammate of Reggie McKenzie, another Detroit native who played on that same offensive line.
And one of those other roommates at MSU was a man named John Shinsky, who was kind of the leader of that group.
You betcha. You betcha, he was. And the three of them together had great lives after football. That's what they felt so blessed to be able to now go back and help.
We're talking to Joe Horrigan, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're Joe Horrigan. If you want to learn more, www.profootballhalloffame.com. Joe, for the last 27 years, you've been in the voting room on the Saturday before each Super Bowl since Super Bowl 24, 1990. What happens in that room on those Saturdays?
Well, you know, it's an amazing thing, Jack, and I've been lucky enough to be the administrator of the selection process for about the last 20 of those 29 years. And it is a system that is a year-round process, as most people don't understand. When we get to that room the day before the Super Bowl, that's the last leg of a year-long process of reducing the nominees down to the final now 18. And our selection committee, now, while we administer the program, we don't vote. That is all done by the selectors who are representatives of media, and there are 48 selectors, 31 from each of the 32 NFL cities, and then 16 that are at-large members that cover the league on a more regional or national basis. You know, people like Jared Bell from USA Today, Peter King from Sports Illustrated, or John Clayton, formerly with ESPN. There are at-large selectors, but the others then come from the cities in which there's an NFL franchise. In any case, they're given the task of taking those 18 nominees, and of the 18, 15 of them are modern era candidates. There are two either seniors or contributors, and the year that they flip, one year it's two seniors, the next year it's one senior, then it's two contributors and one contributor. That's the most that could come out of the 18 out of that, those categories. And then out of the 15 modern era, they can only have five. So we go through a series of reduction votes in there. And when I tell you then what happens in the room, I can't share what's said in the room, but I can tell you that there are 48 men and women. We have male selectors as well. They're in there, and I've never seen a group of people that are more prepared. I've been doing this a long time. They come in with it, and we provide them a lot of statistical evidence and so on, but it's really what they do. Their homework is talk to other players, talk to coaches, talk to candidates, talk to others who've covered the sport for a long time. They come in so prepared to discuss these candidates, and what begins as a discussion sometimes becomes a heated discussion, because it is emotional. You know, people are in there, they have candidates they'd like to see advance, and you know, they know not everybody can. It's a you know, it's a game of numbers. The most we can have on one class is eight, and no fewer than four. Now, you've got 18. I often hear someone say, well, who would you like me to take out to put your guy in? You know, it's a tough, tough decision. But we get locked in a room we start about 7 o'clock in the morning, and we're in there for about anywhere from 9 to 11 hours through this debate, presenting each of these 18 people. And we first talk about the one or two seniors and then the one or two contributors, and then they vote straight up or down on those candidates, yes or no. And then after that, we go to the 15 modern era finalists, and we take the 15 and we discuss them thoroughly. And then we vote the 15 down to 10, discuss that further, and the 10 down to 5, and then up or down on the final 5. So the most you can have is those 3 contributors or seniors, and then the 5 modern era. And they have to get 80% of those 48 selectors. Now, those selectors, as of 2 years ago, we now have 2 members of the media who are also members of the Hall of Fame, and Dan Fouts and James Lofton. So we actually have Hall of Famers in the voting process now. And we do use a lot of our Hall of Famers as consultants, though they don't attend the meeting or vote. They do serve as consultants to the selectors. So it's a very, very thorough process. And like I say, it is year-round. In fact, I'm in Skokie, Illinois right now. But before I came here, the day before I came here, we sent out to our selectors the beginning of the list of nominees for next year for them to start considering and adding names to. So like I say, it's never-ending. It just keeps rotating through.
Our own Jerry Green was in that room for decades, and Mike O'Hara is now in that room. Talk about those two people.
Well, you know, there's two guys that have more knowledge of Detroit sports in general than anybody you'll find. You combine the two of them, and they're dear friends with each other and with me. They have a collective body of work that is second to none. And that is, that's what we look for. You know, when somebody says, how do you choose a selector? And I said, well, I choose a selector based upon what he can contribute to the group. And that is his knowledge. We're looking for the most qualified voice, not necessarily the most colorful person or the highest profile person. And Jerry, you know, Jack has been to every Super Bowl now since 67, I guess, was the first year after the 66 season. He has been dedicated to the sports, been governing it forever, and he's still someone we can rely on to help us when we need him. And it's the same way with all of our selectors. So, it's been a pleasure knowing both of them, and I'm happy that they're still active in the sport.
This past first Saturday of February, the result were 8 new ones. Ray Lewis, mm-hmm. Brian Urlacher, Randy Moss, Terrell Owens, Brian Dawkins, Jerry Kramer, the old guard from the great Packers in the 60s, Robert Brazil from the Oilers, and general manager Bobby Bethard. Joe, how will the lives of these 8 greats change for the rest of their life?
You know, it's already changed for them, and, you know, it's interesting to hear them tell us that. I mean, literally the day after we gathered them together, the day after the Super Bowl for an orientation day, and we talk with them, and they tell us a little bit about their background, which is usually pretty, astounding. There's not a dry eye in the house when these guys start talking about some of their trials and tribulations that they faced. But it changes, kind of like I was saying with Joe D. So many of them realize that it's not about them, that it's about now a new team that they're on. And Deacon Jones used to say it best. He said, you're now on a team that you can't quit. You can't be cut from. You can't be traded from. You can't even die off this team. It's forever. And there's this new fraternity that they're in. Because when you leave pro football, let's face it, most guys leave, they're not happy. They've been cut, or they're too old to play, or the injury has, ended their career. And they're out of the locker room. And this is a locker room they've been in since Pee Wee football. Now there's no locker room for them anymore. So the Hall of Fame becomes that locker room. It becomes a new fraternity, a new team for them. So their life changes that way. It validates what they gave countless hours, thousands and thousands of hours to excel at. But it also, like it was alluding to Joe, it gives them that opportunity that they can take their celebrity and pass it on to a greater good for someone else. And to a man, I hear them tell me every year, and they live up to it, is I'm going to use this gold jacket, this Hall of Fame ring, to promote the things that I can help others to use to exceed or excel in whatever walk of life they choose.
We're talking to Joe Horrigan, who's authored several books. Football Legends of All Time, the Pro Football Hall of Fame's 50th anniversary book, and 98 years of football, 318 men are in the Football Hall of Fame, and 15 of them are undrafted free agents. That's phenomenal. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Joe Horrigan, a man that I've admired and looked up to for the first time I went was 1973 to the induction ceremony. So, great man.
You beat me.
So, These eight new Hall of Famers, describe what they will experience the last weekend of July in the Football Hall of Fame induction weekend.
Yeah, you know, Jack, you know, and you've seen other sports, how they do it. And what we do is so unique. I always say this with humility and pride. We have the best enshrinement ceremony of any, not just sport, I mean, any entity that enshrines or recognizes people for excelling in their profession. We make it about, you know, about community. And Canton just comes together every year to do this over and over again. But as you know, it's basically, we condense it into 3 days, although it overlaps out into about five or six for our local community, but 3 days of just celebrating these new guys, with starting with their gold jacket presentation, which starts on a Friday evening in our Canton Civic Center, where about 4,500 of their closest friends will watch Commissioner Commissioner Goodell and David Baker and the Hall of Famer's chosen presenter literally present him with his gold jacket. That's the first step towards the enshrinement process. And that's a really moving thing because each enshrinee proceeds through a gauntlet of his fellow Hall of Famers, all wearing their gold jackets and some high fives all the way up to the stage. And then his presenter will remove his civilian sport coat, and then the commissioner will hand to the presenter his new gold jacket, which they then place on him. And it's kind of a symbolic, you're in the fraternity now. That's on Friday. Then on Saturday, there's a grand parade. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't seek out parades. But I'm telling you, this parade is one of the most popular things with our Hall of Famers because they can't believe, first of all, the 250,000 people line the streets to see them just every year. And it's that they, you know, are shouting their name. And it's a huge parade. I guess it's now like sixth in size in the United States. But the Hall of Famers love that one. And then they'll go from the parade, they'll come to the Hall of Fame and prepare for the enshrinement ceremony, which is the main focus of everything. And our stage is built into our new stadium. It's a huge, beautiful stage with, you know, giant, you know, backlit LED boards and all the hoopla. It's televised nationally by both ESPN and NFL Network. We've already technically sold it out. There's a few tickets left. If you're trying to get tickets, you better call quick, but already this class is so popular, selling out very, very quickly. But in any case, each of them get up there. Their presenter video is run where their presenter tells a little bit of about the man. His football highlights are shown there as well. And then they unveil the bust together, the presenter and the Hall of Famer. And that really marks it's over. Now you're in. This is the last final act before you are officially in, is to unveil that bust. The presenter then takes his seat, and the Hall of Famer gets up there and usually delivers his very emotional speech, sometimes too long, but nonetheless, it's not about X's and O's. It's about life. It's about their life experience that led them to greatness. And then the following night, we have our Hall of Fame game, and that's nationally televised on NBC. So it ends with gold jacket dinner, it has the enshrinement, it has the game. And then for our fans, we just have what we call the Legends Concert, which we have every year now. And this year we're going to have Maroon 5 as the entertainment. So it's a top-notch performance. So we flip our stadium three times. You know, we have the concert. We have the game first, and then we have the enshrinement, and then the concert. So it's a long, action-packed weekend. We'll have about 700,000 people participate in the various events over the period of time that we're celebrating, and it's like none you've ever seen.
If you want to learn more, www.profootballhalloffame. In 2014, the Pro Football Hall of Fame brought in a new president and executive director, a mountain of a man, bigger than life, David Baker. I mean, the man's hands are unbelievable. He's about 6'8", 350, and he thinks as big as he is, and he decides we're going to start a Hall of Fame village that's going to open in 2019. Talk about David Baker's Hall of Fame village.
Yeah, the only thing bigger than him, and I'll give you a little better description. He's 6'9", and as he says, he's a dozen donuts shy of 400. But it is the only thing bigger than him is his vision. And when he came to us about 3.5, almost 4 years ago now, he came with the idea of, well, you could probably use a hotel here. You know, that would help to have a full-service hotel on the property. And pretty soon that hotel turned into a new stadium, a hotel, a retirement center, a Hall of Fame experience, an indoor water park, 11 football fields, an indoor football field, Center for Athletic Training, and we have a, in short, it's the Disney World of pro football. It is over over 100 acres, and it is just going to be this destination point where we're anticipating, you know, 1 million to 2 million will be coming, as opposed to 250,000 people. It's got youth football. We're going to be to what Little League, or what Williamsport is to Little League, Canton will be to youth football. We're going to have training, performance training center, which will be for training coaches and officiating. We're going to have a again, the concerts will be regular in our stadium. Our stadium is more of a multi-purpose entertainment center. The indoor football center will seat 10,000 people. The other youth fields will be for tournaments, which are, you know, state-of-the-art fields, including lighting and videotaping. A full-service four-star hotel. Street of shops, including such things as Shula's Steakhouse and retail. There'll be a condominium living there. There'll be assisted living for those in need. We call it Legends Landing, where a player who you know, wants to live still in the football environment can stay at this beautiful retirement center. It'll have all sorts of facilities, you know, to assist them, those in need of special attention. So it's really, you know, it's a salute to the game, and we're tying it to the 100th anniversary of the league to celebrate the next century of pro football.
As our time winds down, Joe, what advice to give to our young listeners, please?
Well, you know, I've heard it, and I see it, and I witness it all the time, that the pursuit of excellence, and it's a Vince Lombardi quote, where he says, you can never achieve perfection, but in the pursuit of perfection, you might just reach excellence. And that's what I suggest to anybody, you know, whether you want to be a football player or a brain surgeon, the pursuit of excellence is what you want to always strive for. Try to be the best. Don't settle to be the rest, and don't just settle to be good enough. Be better. And that's, you know, everybody can be better at something. Don't restrict yourself by looking at your limitations. Look to your opportunities and take advantage of them.
Joe Horrigan, you're as nice a man as anyone ever is going to meet, and you're an excellent man as well. Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you. Those are kind words. Thank you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahol.